Welcome to this exclusive Scene Scania podcast, featuring a unique conversation bringing together two of the all-time greats from the world of motorsport, Murray Walker and Sir Stirling Moss. As the voice of motor racing in general, and Formula One in particular, Murray Walker needs no introduction to the generations of motorsports fans who, over the course of half a century, tuned into his commentaries week after week. His high-octane style, drive and enthusiasm, punctuated by the occasional Murrayism, resulted in him becoming the best-known and best-loved motor racing commentator of all time. Sir Stirling Moss, of course, is a legend in his own lifetime, a giant of his sport whose fame endures to this day and who enjoys a unique position in the heart of the nation. His 14-year career, which saw him win more than 200 times, was cut short in 1962 by a near-fatal crash at Goodwood. Although subsequently withdrawing from professional competition, Sir Stirling remained on the scene and retained a high profile. For more than 60 years, his name has been synonymous with the sport he loves and at which he excelled. We hope you enjoy our exclusive podcast of Murray Walker in conversation with Sir Stirling Moss.
I've just been working it out. I think we share 170 years of life between us. And both of us, I don't know if you ever consciously sat down and thought this out, both of us precede Formula One.
And yes, yes.
And most people seem to think that motor racing began with Formula
One.
Yes,
exactly.
But it didn't.
Yeah.
But yeah. Stirling, your career lasted, what, 14 years?
If I hadn't had the crash, it could have been 50 years. Because I had no intention of retiring until, because I think I was at the top of my game, I had no intention of retiring until I was at least 50.
But you've had an absolutely fantastic career, and we can come on to that. But what is even more fantastic to me is that your career racing effectively finished in 1962.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to you in 2012, and you are still in this country in general and in the world, Mr. Motor Racing. How have you done it now?
My father did it for me. My mother wanted to call me Hamish. And my father said, you can think again, we don't want Hamish. And so he said, what about Stirling? And I think Stirling has been an enormous help to me. Enormous help. You know, I mean, really, there was an advert once for cornflakes, and the woman just opened the window and said, come on, Stirling, breakfast is ready. And you know, for that to happen, it was tremendous. You know?
Yeah.
And so I think it's a lot to do with that. And I was obviously competitive, and I would fight like anything. But, you know, I mean, that's the way my personality
is. But given that 1962 is a hell of a long time ago, and that an awful lot of people who are following motor racing now will not have seen you racing before they were born, how is it that you've managed to keep your name in front of the public as well as you have?
I'm glad to hear you say it. I have no idea. Have you any idea?
I have a perfect idea. First of all, and I don't want to spare your blushes, you are generally regarded as the greatest of all time because you had an absolutely unique career nowadays in that you weren't just Formula One and single-seaters, were sports cars as well. And sports cars were as important then as Formula One is now, weren't they?
Yes, they were, yeah.
So how did you feel about the one versus the other?
I preferred sports cars because there's no doubt, I think I was more competitive in a sports car against the other people than in a Formula car. I mean, I could certainly beat Fangio in a sports car, but in a Formula One car, no. And I just for whatever reason, the thing about sports cars, I enjoyed very much. I mean, there were so many more races too. Of course, I mean, you know, we've got Le Mans, which is so long, but then the Targa and the Mille Miglia and the Tourist Trophy. You know, there were so many sports car races.
Why would you have been better than Fangio in a sports car? Were you prepared to stick your neck out more, or?
No, I asked Fangio. I said, you know, why? You know, what is he? He said, I don't like. He said, I like to see the wheels. If you remember, because they had the Mercs had that streamline one. And he said, I want to see the wheels. Well, I think when you're driving, you're not looking at the wheels, you're looking 200 yards ahead.
Yeah.
I never really understood his answer. Yeah. Greatly.
Now, when you began, life in motor racing, at the level you were at, was very different to now. It was freer, it was easier, it was less professional.
It was more fun, in fact.
Which would you prefer, to have been Stirling Moss at the time you were Stirling Moss, or to be Stirling Moss at your level now?
Oh, then.
Why? Oh,
because I think to start with, the tools of your trade, I mean, a Formula One car is a fantastic piece of machinery, but a driver input towards success, I reckon, in the era of the 50s and 60s, probably was maybe 15, 20, 25% even. Now, I think it's right down, as you see by the lap times and so on, is down to probably only 5 or 6%.
Yes, I mean, you drove against Fangio, Mike Hawthorne, so many other of the greats. How do you think you can compare them in any way with the Lewis Hamiltons and the Jenson Buttons and the Sebastian Vettels of today?
Only because of the success that they managed to get. I think that, for instance, I mean, Vettel is doing so well, but he's got the best car. But then how many people are that you could put in that car and would beat him? I don't think that many. I think he is an exceptional driver. I don't think it's just the car. The car obviously counts a lot, and I think it counts more in my era than now. I think that the driver had a bigger input towards the success, which is good.
I think of you as the first professional, real professional.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when you started, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that Formula One and single-seater racing was the province of wealthy amateurs who were having a good time. But you went over there and you made it a lot more professional than it was then, and in some ways right up with where it is now. What was driving you? Was it the money? Was it the...
No, the money. I mean, I had to be professional because I couldn't afford to do it without. I mean, in other words, I got no personal income. I hadn't got any backing. And my father was a successful dentist, but, I mean, he certainly wasn't into running a team or anything. And I just love getting into a car. I like the competition. The biggest point, really, is that the size of the person makes no difference. In other words, people who are big or small didn't make any difference at all. And therefore, I could go in and race and drive myself hard because that was what was required. And I was very fit, I was young, I was impetuous. And I think I've often thought about it. I think impetuosity, which is bad in many ways, but I think in motor racing it probably helps, because if anything happens, you've got to do something instantly, even if it's a wrong thing, maybe. But you need to take some action if a wheel comes off or whatever it is. And I think that being impetuous assisted me on that respect. But that's really more for safety than, shall we say, getting speed.
Yeah, I mean, talking about safety, in your day, to put it very mildly indeed, motor racing was not safe. I mean, Jackie Stewart has said he's lost 34 of his personal friends while he was racing. Motor racing is now as safe as it's ever going to be.
Yeah, very safe. But the part of the reason I did it, Murray, part of the reason, one of the biggest, probably the most important thing for me, was it was dangerous. I mean, when you're 17 years old, 18 years old, you want danger. I mean, why do kids climb, you know, things and so on? I mean, they like the idea, boy, this is a bit dodgy, I'm sure he can't do it. And in motor racing, that is, of course, the number one thing. And you go into a corner and you just hope you've got more, if you like, more courage or more understanding or more whatever it is than the guy you're racing against, and you'll go quicker than he does.
But Stirling, the conditions that applied in your time couldn't possibly apply now, because when you started, it was just after the war. Mm. And the attitude towards death was very different then, wasn't it?
Yes. It was far more accepted because so many people had died.
Yeah.
I mean, now the thought of a person dying, taking part in a sport, is appalling. I mean, really.
Yes.
It really is. But then he made a mistake and he's dead. It was much more accepted, I think, because of the war.
Yes, but... And you... you were not fazed at all when you were racing.
I was. People say, "What do you think? Has a friend got killed here or there?" And I had to tell myself. I mean, poor old Pete Collins lost it at Nürburgring, yes. Went into a tree, and I had to just tell myself, if it had been me, I'm sure I would have been a little bit later there or a little bit earlier here, or I'd have cut in a, you know, in other words, make an excuse, because nearly every shunt I've ever had, I think, was because something broken came off the car, which, of course, in those days was quite common. Now it's not.
Now, you must have broken virtually every bone in your body.
Most of them, yes.
Yes. And that never put you off? You never
think, because once you have a shunt, that you go into hospital and they patch you up and you want to get back in there.
I've often thought the likes of Schumacher, yourself, Jenson Button, Lewis Hamilton, were living a fantastic life. You're travelling the world, yeah. You've got a very exciting job. And then all of a sudden, because your reflexes start to go at, I don't know, 35, 40 or whatever it is, that stops and this wonderful, glamorous, interesting travelling life you've had is over. Did you miss it? Did you miss the buzz when you stopped?
Oh, tremendously.
I mean, what sort of withdrawal symptoms did you have?
Well, I didn't have symptoms because I'd made the decision, because that decision I made at Goodwood was something I felt was the only decision I could take. I think I tried myself out too early.
Yes.
My speeds were adequate, but my concentration wasn't, yeah. And the concentration to drive a racing car is very important, and I think if I waited 2 or 3 years I might have managed to come back. But then against that, here was a young guy called Jimmy Clark who was fantastic, and he was, you know, coming up, and then of course the cars were changing, they were getting slicks and all this sort of stuff, so it completely changed. So I'm not in any way worried about having made the wrong decision. I think I made it too early, that's all.
Yeah, and knowing what you know now and the state of medicine and all that sort of thing, how long do you think you ought to have left it or could have left it before you...
I had every intention, quite honestly, Fangio was world champion at 47, and I was certainly as fit as Fangio, and I know I could have kept that fit as fit as I needed to, and I was thinking, you know, somewhere around 50 years old. I don't see why not, if one's prepared to keep oneself, yes, fit and constant. Yes. So that would have been my intention.
But in 62, when you came back and tested yourself, you say now that you did it too soon. If you'd left it for 2 years,
yeah,
do you think you could have come back as you were before?
I think it would have been very difficult. It would have been difficult, made far more difficult because of Jimmy Clark, actually. Because Jimmy was getting to the point... when I had my crash, when I said to Rob Walker, you know, I'm not going to be able to have a car that's 1 or 2 years old and beat this guy because he's that good. I'm going to need something.
You could see that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he was brilliant. I frankly think that if I hadn't had that crash or another crash, but that crash particularly, I think that I would have carried on. Yeah, I really do.
What do you think that the Jim Clarks, the Sebastian Vettels, the Stirling Mosses of this world, which lift them above the others, have got that the others haven't? Is it physical? Is it mental?
I think a lot of it is mental. I think, frankly, I really do. I mean, the physical side, you've got the point is my limitation because of fear came in before other things. In other words, I go around a corner and I think, well, I can. There's another foot left. I should be able to keep my foot down a bit longer. And I could force myself to do that. I could force myself to try and get a qualifying lap, to break a little bit later, but more importantly, put the power on a little bit earlier and things like that. And I think that one's life as a racing driver is one of the mental side where you've got to say, look, danger is not what I'm worried about. The danger is there, and I certainly know about danger because I had so many things break. But I felt that. I honestly can't remember any time where I think probably I may have caused the accident. I really, really.
But 50 years later, you go out and you say to yourself, "I've frightened myself. I'm now going to stop," which you've just done recently.
Yeah.
What was it that you did that frightened yourself, and how did you feel?
Quite interesting. I didn't really do much. I went round in the car, fantastic car. Everything felt good, and I'm going through this series of corners. And I suddenly realised that if I was going to be competitive, I was going to have to go faster. Other people were getting quicker. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go faster, I'm going to be nervous. And nervousness is a sign of fear. And once that's allowed us even the slightest chink, that's it. It's
fear. Was that the first time you'd experienced
First time
that
I've ever experienced. Really? Other than I frightened myself because I go around, something happened, you know, yes. I mean, steering shears or whatever it is.
Sterling, one of the bones of contention these days is team orders. That yeah. Driver A and driver B are in the team, and the team gives driver A an instruction to drop back and let driver B yeah. through. People get terribly aerated about it these days and say it's not fair. What do you think about team
Well, I mean, frankly, the only team orders we have, say, at Mercedes... was one thing, when a Mercedes, it doesn't matter if it's you, me or whose it is, a Mercedes gets 30 seconds lead on the rest of the field, which in those days was possible, then they hung out a sign that said REG, regulare. So that meant then you kept your position. I felt sorry for Tony Brooks because when I signed with Vanwall, I signed as number one, which number one meant that if I want your engine, I get your engine. And, of course, occasionally something would happen and poor old Tony would have to give me his engine or his car or whatever. But that's what one signs up as number one for. Yeah.
You've got to be a bit ruthless, haven't you? I mean, you had no inhibitions about saying, his engine's better than mine, I'll have that one.
No, none at all. I mean, I should have done. I mean, I felt sorry for him, if you like, but I mean, after all, number one matters, doesn't it? You're number one, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I heard a lovely story the other day about Bernie Ecclestone in his earlier days. He had an aeroplane and he bought up all the spares, all the spare engines and everything. For that plane, yeah. He got the whole lot. And somebody said to him, what happens if someone else wants it? They're going to be in trouble, aren't they? Yeah, I suppose they are, he said.
I can see what he means. It's awful, but I can see what he means.
Another bone of contention these days is what I can best describe as pay drivers.
Yes.
In Formula One, there are some drivers who had better be nameless, but Pastor Maldonado is certainly one of them, who are alleged to have their position in the team because they've given the team a great deal of money. And the people who don't know as much about it as they should do get on their high horses about this and say it's not fair because there's probably other people who are just as good as him, if not better. Yeah. Why can't they have the drive? What do you feel about pay drivers? Did they exist in your day?
No, nobody would. I mean, we're lucky if we got paid to do what we did.
Yes. Never mind paying to do it.
Exactly. No, I mean... Well, the sport has so changed. It's no longer a sport. It's a fantastic business. And I respect the drivers and the cars and everything. But there's an awful lot of things that are not able to be a sport. I mean, it is a business and that's it. And I suppose that comes into being a business.
The drivers these days are... I said I regarded you as the first professional, and I do. But in general, the drivers now are a lot more professional than they used to be. Do you think they suffer as a result of this?
Yes. Why? I think certainly some of them. But then you see some drivers, I think probably Gilles Villeneuve was one of them, or Jacques maybe, but who says, you know, doing all the PR, he doesn't like doing PR. Personally, I enjoy doing PR. I like to go, we didn't have sponsors in my day, but now if I had a sponsor, for instance, I had to go and talk to them after the race. That's how it goes.
Yes, but you had a lot more fun in those days, didn't
you? Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the drivers these days, it seems to me, they're either racing or testing or working for the sponsor or going to another Grand Prix. Don't talk to each other very much. They don't...
No.
Fraternise with. They don't travel together. They don't stay in the same hotels together. They don't eat in the same restaurants together. But you were all mates, weren't
That's
you?
That's extraordinary. Yeah. Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, we'd go round together in a group.
That's another thing with you. I think it's fair to say that most top racing drivers are not natural businessmen.
Mm.
You are. You will go in somewhere and haggle and get the price down or get your price up. I mean, is that something you've trained yourself to do, or is it something,
something
that's
I
just
enjoy
come naturally?
I think negotiation of that way, look, I'll do this, let's have a contract, you do that, and so on.
I remember when we were in Singapore 1 year together, I said to you, there's a cracking Chinese tailor down the road. And you said to me, does he do shirts? And I said, yeah, I think so. He said, you said double cuffs? And I said, yeah, I think so. And he said, hidden buttons? And I said, yeah, probably. He said, you said, how much does he charge? I said, 20 quid. He said, you said, I've got an Indian chap who does them for 15 for me in London, Murray. And I said, oh, yeah. And you said, but did you haggle with him, Murray? And I said, I'm no good at that, Sterling. And you said, well, it's their way of life, and you ought to do it. So I was actually in the market to get a Braun electric razor. And I got up the next morning, I thought, Sterling's right. I work for my money just as hard as anybody else. Why shouldn't I? I'm not going to get... I went round, trudging round electric shops and got them. I got this razor I wanted for 55 quid. When I got home, I looked at the Argos catalogue and it was 48 quid. so I wonder whether there was strength in your way of going about it or not.
Yeah, there's a lot of enjoyment there too, you know, really.
What? How do you think Bernie Ecclestone's affected the sport?
I think he's done a lot.
Compared with your day?
Well, you can't really compare it because it is, you're taking a sport and a business, and there's no doubt now. I think he's done a tremendous amount for it. I mean, the thing that changed motor racing really was television. When television started, then money started to flow in. And I mean, because when I was racing, it was very little. I mean, you'd see the Finnish flag, you know, a little bit on British movie tone news. And, of course, it's all changed.
That is true, but the three British drivers who have stood out in terms of personal achievement and personal fame more than any others are yourself, James Hunt, and Nigel Mansell. But Hunt and Mansell both did it in a television era.
Yeah.
Nigel more than James, admittedly. But you didn't. Television didn't exist to the same extent if at all. But yet you were world famous.
Yeah, I think the one thing I must say is that all my life I've been, I hope, approachable. I mean, I've been in the telephone book under S for Sterling and under M for Moss. And anybody could get the thing and ring up. And I always made myself as approachable, if you like. If a press guy's writing a story and he thinks, well, let's ask somebody, I like to hope they'd call me up and say, right, well, Sterling said this or that. Because even if you're not paid for it, and you're not on those sort of things, it increases the value, really, of what you are.
Yes, indeed.
And I think it's quite important.
Like everything else in life, you've got to work at it.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I'm negotiating now. I'm redoing my home. And so, obviously, if I can get decent discounts and so on, because I do a contra deal or whatever it may be, that's all in the deal.
You and I must sit down one day and you must tell me how you do it.
You could do it, I'm sure, by God. You're the only man I know who's ever written a really great book and hasn't had to pay an agent. It's extraordinary.
Well, Sterling, when I was asked to do the book, and thank you, yes, I did very well out of it.
Yeah.
I had to, and you've been in the same position, I'm sure. I had to ask myself two questions. One, are you going to write it, Murray, or is a ghostwriter going to write it?
Yeah.
And I said to myself, well, nobody knows me better than I know me.
Very true.
And if I'm talking to somebody, he's going to interpret me and not be me.
Yeah.
So I'll write it. Second thing was, I said to myself, are you going to do it through an agent, Murray, or are you going to negotiate your own deal? And then I said to myself, well, if I have an agent do it, he'll take 20% of what I get.
Yeah, quite.
And the Chancellor will take 50% of what I get. So that's going to leave me with 30% of what I earned. And so I'm going to do it myself. And I did it myself, and it worked out better.
It did.
And I like to think the book was a lot better because I wrote it. And certainly financially, I did better.
Yeah.
But this is not something I can do all the time that you can do. What about the great drivers, Sterling? Fangio, obviously.
Fangio I put as number one. You can't really compare drivers of today with then because of the danger factor.
Well, I'm glad people say to me, who's the greatest? But
today there's no doubt at the moment that Vettel is, and he's fantastic. He's funny. He's a really great bloke, you know, to be a world champion. I think because he's funny and he's a German after all, and he does Cockney slang and, you know, very, very complete. But you can't compare when you go into a race, if you're running on the road, which I find the best anyway, you can't look upon that it's certainly a lot more dangerous, shall we say, than an aerodrome. And now you've got these great spin-off areas. And luckily I was in there when it was dangerous, because I think it gave much more exhilaration to the driver, more feeling of achievement and all those sort of things.
Can you put your finger on why it is that Vettel is so exceptional? I mean, only eight people have, in the history of Formula One, have had successive world championships. Yeah. And he's 24, and he's done it. And he's got, by your standards, he's got at least another 16 years ahead of him.
If he wants it, certainly.
What's made him so special?
I suppose it has to be his feeling of the car, like Jim Clark had. I mean, Jimmy could get into a car and drive it, and I'd like to hope that I could too. You feel what the car's benefits are and its problems are, the way to get round its slide, its rollover steer or whatever it is, and you adjust the car with the mechanic and then you get it the way you want it. I mean, I felt that if I'd ever taken Jack Brabham's car and driven it, I know I'd have been miles slower than he would. If he'd taken mine, I'm sure it would be the same thing, because our styles of driving were quite, you know, completely different, really. I think that's an important thing, and I just think that a driver like Vettel, I suppose, just has a tremendous concentration. He's very fit. Well, they're all fit, but they're only short, of course. The race is 1 hour 10. In my day, there were 3 hour minimum on the Formula One, which made quite a difference, actually.
But he's unusual in that, being a top racing driver, he has got a sense of humour. When I retired, they threw a big party for me in the paddock.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what it was all about. And I saw Michael Schumacher was sitting there. So I thought, well, if it's good enough for Michael Schumacher, it's certainly, certainly good enough for me. So I went and sat next to Michael. And Tony Jardine, you know Tony Jardine?
Sure.
Tony Jardine was making... There was Bernie was there, Flavio Briatore was there, Tony George, who owns Indianapolis, was there. They were all there, and Tony was getting drivers to come out, and he'd give them a piece of paper on which were written things that I was alleged to have said. And he was making them say this like I did. So he gets Michael out, and written on this piece of paper is, "Here comes Michael Schumacher, son of Ralph Schumacher," which I obviously would not have said.
No, quite.
And Michael looks at this, he said, "I don't understand." He said, what do I have to do? And Tony said, "You have to say it like Murray said it." And Michael said, "But when Murray says it, I'm in the car and I can't hear him," which is true. So I put my arm round him and said, "Come on, Michael, we'll do it together." And we did it together. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, "Can you help me, Murray?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "What is it?" He said, "This party was in your honour after your years of TV commentating, was it?" I said, "Yes." He said, "But they were all making fun of you." And I said, "Well, it's just our way, Michael, I think." He said, "Is it your English sense of humour?" And I said, "Yes, I think it must be, Michael." "Oh, I see," he said. But I don't think he did see. But that's something that Vettel's got, isn't it?
Yes.
Sense of humour.
Yes, amazingly. Yes. Well, not amazingly, but I mean, a Vettel is such a complete what a racing driver should be, in my mind. Immensely fast, very nice to talk to, and good sense of humour and all these things. I mean, he is certainly a great asset to the sport, I think, at the moment.
Sterling, two great people in the history of motorsport, both of whom you knew very well. Colin Chapman, the chap who started and developed Lotus and made it the great racing team it was, and Alfred Neubauer, who was the team boss of Mercedes-Benz for whom you drove. Can you contrast them as personalities?
Completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, Colin Chapman had no sense of humour.
Oh, really?
I won the US Grand Prix driving a Lotus in 1959 or 60, and it was my birthday. And they had a cake, and they gave me this cake. And I cut a wheel off and said, would you like to give this to Colin? He didn't think it was funny at all. I thought it was really amusing. I mean, how many wheels have I had come off?
Because he was notorious for making flimsy racing cars.
Well, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, he was brilliant at what he did. No doubt about it. I think that he and Jimmy were a fantastic team. I mean, Jimmy would have been wasted with most other people, whereas with Colin, certainly he wasn't. I mean, he got everything.
Did Clark have a sense of humour? Was he a bit dour, serious Scottish farmer?
Yes.
He was not a fun guy.
No, not really. No. I mean, he was like Tony Brooks, really, who in my mind is also a fantastic driver who really wasn't known for being as good as he was.
Bit serious.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, more so than the rest of us missing around.
What about Tony Vandeville? What was he like?
Tony Vandeville, I think, was as like Ferrari as he would hate to be. I mean, he was very, very. He would. The trouble with Tony is he'd get in his car and try and drive it, and you know, and that would get him, slip the clutch or something, and it didn't do it any good at all.
Was he a likable chap, or was he?
Yes, when he was in a good mood, he was. I think a bit probably like Ferrari was, really. I mean, I didn't know either of them that well. I mean, I drove for Tony, but driving for a guy like that, you're driving for the PR side.
You always insisted on driving British cars.
To your detriment,
is that the right word? Why?
Because I was English and I was very pro-English. I just loved, being with the green car and the whole thing. The war was just over, I suppose. I was very proud of it and that's what happened, really.
But what was it that finally drove you into Maserati's arms and therefore into an Italian car rather than
a
British car?
It's interesting you say that. I had a meeting of all the press people over here, the Express and Basil Cardew, and I've gotten together only about 12 or 14 of them. I said, look, I have a difficult problem. I want to drive a British car, but I can't find one. They said, look, we'd rather have a British driver driving a foreign car than not winning the race anyway. I said, no, certainly get a Mazza. And that's why I got the Mazza. Well, actually, I got the Mazza because Neubauer suggested it to my father. Because when my father went down to see if they'd take me for 1954, which is when Merckx came out, they said, look, we know how well he's doing in a pretty awful car. Because the HWM, and then after that, of course, ERA, we were not very good. And he said, but we'd like to see him driving something that might win. And then we went to Bern it was raining.
Yes.
On the first day, and I managed to put my Mazda on pole in front of all the rest of them, including Fangio. And that's when Neubauer he didn't sign me up, but that's when he made the decision.
Racing nowadays is just as much about the chaps in the pit lane and strategy and all that stuff as it is about the driver.
Yes.
In your day, I won't say you got in the car and drove the wheels off it, but it was far more like that.
So
do you think that racing has suffered because of that?
Oh, certainly I do. I mean, I think there's no team orders and all that's ridiculous, but I mean, I think the driver is the only person, mind you, cars are much more reliable now, but the driver's the only person who knows what condition the car is in when I'm driving. I can tell that brake is inclined to lock or I'm getting a bit of oil surge on the tight corners or whatever it is, and you drive accordingly. And therefore you have to learn a bit about that side of the car. And our Francis would explain anything to me. And so I would, right from the start, try and save as much as I could with the car because they were less reliable then.
I think motorsport, Formula One, is a lot more difficult to understand now than it was in your day. Because in your day, you knew that it was you and the car.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you don't know to what extent the tyres are making a contribution, to what extent the chap on the pit lane who is saying, turn it down to number three, Stirling, because the mixture's too rich or whatever, do you?
I can't. I mean, I was thinking, you know, driving the car and suddenly it comes on the intercom and sort of says, listen, we think you should do this or that.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
That thank God never did happen. I mean, I don't know what I'd have done with it. I mean, to think there's somebody over there, big brother, watching you and saying, listen, now you must turn this down or bring that up.
You started in 1948, you finished in 1962. You raced against so many of the greats that I won't attempt to list them. But does any one name come to the top of your mind when you think of the rivals that you raced against?
Yeah, Tony Brooks.
Oh, really?
I would say, I mean, Fangio certainly in Formula One, but Formula One was really a small part of racing. I mean, I was doing over 50 races, and only eight of them were world championship, I believe. You know, not many. So Formula One hadn't really taken off like it has now, because now in the world there are many other types of racing, it's true. But the only one that seems to matter to people, in Europe anyway, is of course the world championship. So it has changed an awful lot.
So what was so special about Tony that made you worry about
him? Well, Tony was extremely fast in both Formula One and sports cars, which was pretty unique. I think he was careful with the cars. I mean, I know how delicate the cars were at that time, and Tony was extremely fast. I mean, I'll tell you that in the year with Van Wall, we had the Stuart Lewis Evans, who was another guy who was amazingly fast, Tony and myself. And boy, I mean, I really had to try to be able to go faster than he could. And obviously you judge people by your standard, you know what lap times you're doing. And he was certainly the one that if I had had a team myself, I would want him to lead the team. Because he was so adept to one car to another, and he's you know, very easygoing sort of person, you know. I mean, and yet he takes his racing very
seriously.
But
what did he say when you said, you're number two, I'm going to have your engine?
He didn't like it. And I must say, I can understand it.
So can I, yeah.
I really could, you know, but that's what I was working for, number one.
Something that was very special in your day and that doesn't exist now can be summed up in the word versatility. You were like Mike Harewood in many ways. You would jump into any car, be it a 500cc Cooper or a 4.5 litre Maserati or a big Mercedes sports car or a touring car or a Formula One Van Wall or a Cooper or a Lotus. And I won't say they were all the same to you, but you always got the best out of them. That doesn't apply anymore. It's all so specialised.
No. I think... Well, one can understand it because the very best, there are so many near being the very best. I'm not talking about drivers, I'm talking about cars. And I mean, they all do this many revs and they all do that. They are very, very similar, which of course in my era they weren't.
So how do you feel about the sport now compared with your day? Well, I mean, you sit and watch television, do you?
It's not comparable, Murray. You can't really compare motor racing then and now. No, there's no comparison. I mean, I find it interesting because it is amazing to me that those cars would stick to the ceiling at 100 miles an hour. I find that quite fascinating. The lateral G they can get because of downforce is just staggering. And I'm interested in that, but it isn't really very exciting.
Stirling, you, like me, are not a young man. You, unlike me, have broken every bone in your body, but you are still incredibly fit and you are still incredibly alert. Is this something you work at, or is this something that comes naturally, or is this something that happens as a result of your lifestyle?
No, my lifestyle is the way it has to be.
No. You make your lifestyle.
Yes, but that's the answer. Oh. I've made it, therefore I like it.
All right.
No, but my lifestyle, I think, suits me very well, and getting around and going different places. I still am fit. I'm nothing like as fit as I was, obviously, but I am very fit. You're continually being held as somebody I should aspire to. My wife's always saying, Murray won't do this, Murray doesn't do that, he does it like this. So I'm continually being compared with you. But
what about, we've talked about incredible men that we've both come across, Bernie Ecclestone, Enzo Ferrari, Colin Chapman, and some, and the drivers that you've raced against. What about Charles March, Goodwood?
Well, Charles March is, I mean, everybody, every event of that type is, wants to be like it. I mean,
yes.
He sets the seal of
yes.
being the best. And he does it because of, he's got, because of, A, first of all, his personality. He's a hell of a businessman.
Yes.
I mean, you know, if one's doing a contract...
I know, I've tried to do business with
well,
him.
Exactly.
He always seems to win. I don't know
well,
why it
I
is.
Come out of it, you know, I said to Susan, I reckon I've got it. She said, well, just a minute, haven't you done this? And I suddenly find, well, this all levels
oh,
out
really?
Again.
Well,
but he is a fantastic businessman. I think that it goes back to his father when Goodwood was really starting, of course, in the very early days. And he did such a fantastic job there. The person we have to thank for Goodwood, really, you know, is Tony Gaze. Because Tony Gaze was flying in the Australian Air Force out of there
yes.
or somewhere around. And he turned to Freddie, the Duke of Richmond at that time, and said, you know, this could be a good racetrack. And so we really have to thank him for it. And of course, for
yes, it's an incredible testimony to Charles, I think, that from the germ of an idea to have a thing called the Festival of Speed, he's now got an event in that and the other one, the Goodwood Revival, that people from all over the world,
oh,
wealthy
yeah.
car
oh,
owners,
yeah.
vie with each other to go to. And one of the reasons they vie to go to it is because you've been the star attraction of Goodwood ever since it began, haven't you? You must have done more miles at Goodwood
yes.
than anybody else.
Yes, tremendous amount.
Yeah.
But I must say, I do enjoy going there because you see people from all over the world again that have come in from Australia and it doesn't matter where, but they arrive there. It's the place that anybody putting, there's one being done at Dusseldorf I'm making an appearance at later this year, and the one thing they want to do is try and be like Goodwood, because Goodwood is so efficiently run, so well run, and, you know, and it's just a great thing to be there.
I regard myself as... a bit of a ham, because I like standing up and talking to people, particularly about something that I'm interested in. And my wife says, if it hasn't got an engine, he's not interested. You're good at it. Do you regard yourself as a bit of a ham? Do you enjoy it?
I enjoy it. Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, of course I enjoy it, because I talk about myself quite a lot.
And yes,
that's,
sure.
that's something I like to
and
do.
They listen.
They listen, exactly. Yeah. No, I think that long as they're an enthusiast, I go and give talks and so on, and as long as the people are enthusiastic, that it's a wonderful repayment, if you like, really, for going along doing what one does.
It's very, I mean, I'm going to sound a bit pompous now, but it's very heartening to see the youth of today being interested in what you're interested in and wanting to be what you have been, isn't it?
Yes, very, it's very humbling, I must say. It's
and there's a lot of them all around the world.
Yeah, I know I get fan letters, and some of them are very amazing to me. You know, I mean, the really amazing thing, though, is I think that a man has to be over middle age, or certainly up to middle age, to have ever
yes.
seen me drive.
Yes,
and,
yes.
So therefore, they're either reading things and so on, which is very nice, and... that's the way life
but
is.
you've done a lot of books. And
well, I haven't, because I'm not like you. I haven't got the talent to write. I speak to another guy and he takes it away. And
well,
and
I've got at least 8 books at home that are about you or allegedly written by you. And you do this Stirling Moss scrapbook at Goodwood every year,
right.
And you go to signing sessions, and the people are clustering around. I mean, it's a honeypot situation. and you are the attraction. Your fame and personality have remained undimmed for an enormous period of time.
Yes, I'm very grateful for that. Very grateful.
At this point, we thought we'd turn the tables and ask Sir Stirling to question Murray about his past and how he came to be the nation's favourite sports commentator.
Murray, you've been a household name for most of my life, and... how did you get into it?
Well, it's a combination of birthright and nepotism, I think, Stirling. I was born into, like you in many ways, our paths have been parallel. in that I was born into a motorsport environment. My dad was a professional racing motorcyclist and a very successful one. So I, like you, grew up in an atmosphere where motorsport was all around you all the time. And I think most boys in life either love what their father did or hate what their father did. And I worshipped my father, who was an exceptional man, and I wanted to be like him. And I started racing bikes after the war, and I thought, I'll show the old man how it really ought to be done. And I very rapidly discovered that I wasn't going to show the old man how it ought to be done. And I wasn't good enough to, unlike you, I wasn't good enough to satisfy myself. And you know what they say, those that can, do, and those that can't, talk about it. And I started talking about it, and my father by then was the BBC's commentator on motorcycle racing. And I worked with him from 1948 until 1962 when he died. And we were the only father and son commentary team the BBC had ever had. And all, you and I have both been terribly lucky in that we have both done all our lives something we wanted to do.
Absolutely fantastic. I mean, I've never had a day in my life where I've thought, oh God, I don't want to go to work.
Neither have I.
Yeah, well, that, and we're so lucky.
Yes, we are. And we are both very lucky in that we haven't had a mandatory cut-off period like being 60 years of age where someone says, right, you're retired, sunshine. You've gone on with your interests and I've gone on with my interests, and I think it's probably literally kept us both alive.
I agree. How much do you miss it?
If I'm totally honest with you, Sterling, I miss it more than I can say, because Formula One, as you well know, is a gigantically challenging environment. Everybody who is in Formula One is very good at what they do. Doesn't matter whether he's a tyre fitter, a mechanic, an IT man, the team principal, the driver, they're all top people. And they're all vying with each other in an environment where next weekend is going to be another major challenge. And I regard myself as terribly lucky to have been in that environment all my life.
But how about Murray's commentary style? How does he look back on it and the way in which it developed over the years?
If you listen to Murray Walker doing commentary in the early days, it is incredibly stilted and uninformed compared with now. Because in my day, I remember being at Monza one year, and there were two cameras at Monza. One was on the side of the grandstand that I was in, looking down at the parabolica. So you saw them come out of the parabolica, and they sort of pulled focus. So the car never actually got any bigger until it went past you. And the other was at what is now called the Ascari Benz. And when they weren't in vision, you just had to keep talking and fill in the gaps. And I sit now sometimes and listen to stuff that I've done in a state of excruciating embarrassment because it is so uninformative compared with now. Now, there are umpteen cameras around the circuit. There are cameras in every position on the car. There's cameras on the driver's helmet. You're going round the whole track and you've got somebody telling you what is happening. Martin Brundle and David Croft, it will be on Sky, and it's going to be Ben Edwards and David Coulthard on the BBC. And they've got so much information in terms of telemetry and video screens, I would have given my eye teeth to have had it. Because if you're the viewer now, you know everything that's happening, or you should do. I mean, I always regarded my job as being not just to inform, because anybody can inform, but to entertain as well.
Paint the picture.
And I used to stand in the commentary box. I never sat down. I was on the balls of my feet all the time. The adrenaline was pouring out of me by the bucketful. James Hunt would be sitting beside me in a sullen heap when he was doing it. Martin Brundle used to stand up, and Martin stood up because he said, if old Murray can stand up, then I can stand up. We used to communicate with a series of hand signals. But I say I regarded my job as to entertain, and hopefully I didn't find it difficult to do so because I was so passionate about it myself. And that's why I got the reputation for making mistakes. Because when you're looking at a television screen and you're watching a Formula One race and something exciting happens, you haven't got the opportunity to say, shall I say it this way, or shall I say it that way, or shall I say it that way? You say what comes into your mind, mouth straight away. And sometimes you get it wrong. The words come out in the wrong order, or the wrong words come out, or you get them the wrong way round, or you fail to identify a driver. And that's why the critics sitting at home with their television set and they're just concentrating on the screen and they don't have to say anything about it, say, why don't they get someone who knows what he's talking about?
But how has all this technology, the technology that entertains us week in, week out, come about? What or who has been the driving force behind the advancement of Formula One?
It's Bernie Ecclestone, actually, if you think about it. I mean, in your day and in my early day, it was all a bit rough and ready, take it as it comes, here it is. As a result of Bernie's magnificent input, and Formula One wouldn't be what it is if it wasn't for Bernie. It is now a highly polished and gigantically professional product. It wasn't a product in your day. It was an exciting happening.
Murray, of course, became for many years an integral part of the product, which is Formula One. But if it hadn't have happened for him, what alternative would have been his dream?
People have said to me, and this, what I'm about to say is true. I'm not saying it just because I'm here. If you hadn't been you, who would you like to have been? And I would have liked to have been either Stirling Moss or Mike Harewood.
Really?
Because they did to perfection what I would love to have done.
I must say, I'd like to have done what he did at, or any of the top ones at the Isle of Man. Because that, to me, is a real circuit.
Yes. Oh,
I mean, real bloody circuit.
They are the absolute pinnacle of our sport, as far as I'm concerned. But then I'm biased in favour of bikes because of my personal background.
Yeah. I'm not biased in any way. There's no doubt that the bike race is far more exciting than cars.
Yes, it is.
Because there's more room to get more of them
together.
That's the thing.
I mean, because they occupy less of the road than the car.
Yeah.
Now, apropos of that, nowadays we see drivers with a complete lack of fear banging wheels with each other and overlapping wheels with each other. You wouldn't have done that, would you?
No way. But it's dangerous. You see, now I can't think of any way a driver could be killed if he stays in his car and something else comes. Hits him. That could a wheel like Paul Johnson's son was terrible, but that's the only way. I mean, otherwise, would you've seen him? I mean,
well, Kubica, that thing in Canada.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. I mean, but so many. There was who went off 160 miles an hour. I forget who it was, and was quite okay, as long as they stay in the and they're strapped in like hell.
Because
those cars are so strong, it's unbelievable.
And the cars were mobile death traps in your day, weren't they?
I mean, really, you want to be sure to get out as quickly as you can. So you've got 42 gallons of fuel in the back and you've got down the side and over you. It's a sort of adrenaline thing, The fact that it's dangerous is exciting, really. I mean, if you and I played cards and we're playing just for chips, it wouldn't mean anything. But if you start paying for a penny, it begins to mean something. And when it gets to your life as a stake, then, my God, it means a hell of a lot.
We haven't really talked about the sports car thing, but in your mind, which gives you the greatest satisfaction?
I think the greatest achievement I had, really, was the Mille Miglia.
Yeah.
Because when any circuit I went to, I knew like the back of my hand, and I don't care if it was Nürburgring, what have you. I knew every bit of it. When you go in the Mille Miglia, you know none. I mean, really, take 2 days to do one lap. And so by the time you get round, so you really don't know it at all, other than what it is what it's going to be like. And to go out on the thing like that, and they say 5 million spectators, I wouldn't know, but a lot of people watched it. And when you're coming through, and the people are standing on the edge, you know, and they lean forward. When you're coming through, you can't see the road, so you don't know where the apex is until you go in. So the style is completely different. When you know you're driving on a road, you know where the apex is, you know exactly when you're going to turn in the tunnel in Monaco, which is quite difficult. But in that way, you have no idea, because you go in, so you've got to go in with the car just on the edge, so that if suddenly it gets tighter than you thought, you back off, which gives you a set oversteer, and then you correct, depending on the amount that you take off and the power you put in, affects very much on the car's trajectory. And that's what makes it so difficult.
And you're doing all that unseen in the Mia Miglia, aren't you?
Mm. Yeah. And the speed, you see, were great. I mean, the last segment to Cremona, to Brescia, that car averaged 169.1 miles an hour.
And that's in
1955.
Fantastic.
Averaged on the last, and that's from a standing start.
Sterling, I know what your father's attitude was to you racing, because in many ways he was responsible for you going racing, and he supported you, and with your manager got cars and all that sort of thing. What was your mother's attitude?
My mother really kept quiet, because she was obviously very frightened of it, really.
Yes.
And she'd come to certain races, and if you know, she didn't bite her nails, but if she could bite her nails, you know, she would have done.
Yes. Don't you, to be a top racing driver, where you are up against rivals, and particularly the chap in your team, don't you have to be selfish?
Yes, you do. But it's not a nice thing to be, but you do. And I mean, I'm impetuous and selfish and God knows what else. And all those bad things are necessary to you know, to hone yourself to get to do what you do.
And did that come naturally, or did you have to force yourself to do it?
No, it came naturally, I think, because I was competitive at school. See, I'm not very big. In fact, I'm really quite small for my age, and people not age at school. And you know, the big buggers would pick on you. Well, once I got into a motor car, a man's size or power meant nothing. I was equal with everybody. You know, it made a big difference.
It's interesting because you say that, and Jackie Stewart says the same thing about being dyslexic.
Really?
Yeah, he suffered the agonies of the damned at school because of his dyslexia, and being in the car put him on an equal footing with other people.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, because Jackie and I are completely opposing views, you see. I mean, I reckon that you don't pad a tree, you put one there. You drive around the bugger.
Yeah.
In his case, you cut it off and it's not there to hit, you know, and then it's totally different. I mean, because he never races in an unsafe era. I mean, less safe than now, but I mean, it was pretty safe by then.
Oh, come on, he would argue vehemently with you about that. Jackie would say, hang on, Sterling, he said, I lost 34 of my friends. François Sever, for instance, was responsible for him retiring from racing. I think Jackie would be at odds with you.
No, you're right. No, you're quite right. Yeah.
Turning to the crystal ball, how about the future? Where do Murray and Sir Sterling see Formula One going over the next decade?
Where will Formula One be in 10 years' time? 10 years isn't all that long, actually. I don't know that I'm looking forward to it, and I hope I'm here. With enormous enthusiasm, because road cars are going down the electric car and the hybrid car road. Formula One cars are starting to go down the same road. I mean, this season, is it this season or next season, they're going to have to go down the pit lane on battery power.
Oh, are they?
Yes.
Really? Really?
Yeah, and not... imagine,
be quiet, won't it?
Well, all the noise is going to go. Imagine you see Vettel going silently down the pit lane. Now, it's always going to be men in cars, and I think it's always going to be men in cars rather than women and men in cars, which is another controversial subject. It's always going to be men in cars trying to go faster in circles than the other bloke. But I don't think I'm going to enjoy the cars that they're in as much as I enjoy them now, and I enjoyed them even more when there was an engine in front of the driver.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, no, I must say, I mean, now, for instance, four-wheel drive, I don't know if it's still outlawed, but it was banned, which I think was a big mistake. It should carry on. But because I really feel that Formula One should be make any car you like, any way you like, petrol, diesel, whatever you like.
Yes.
It's going to be the fastest car to do, well, it was 3 hours, it's now an hour and a quarter. I think that would be quite interesting, quite stimulating. But the trouble is...
Well, it's never going to happen, is it?
No.
And I'll tell you why it's not going to happen, because the governing body would say the cars will be so fast that they're going to become terribly dangerous. They'll be flying into the crowd. They'll be killing tens of people, like happened at Le Mans in 1955. And if that happened, the world, the sport would be outlawed worldwide. Yeah.
But they keep trying to limit things, and it only does a certain amount of good.
I tell you something that I don't like now compared with what I did like when you were racing. And that is, when you were racing, I could see you. Nowadays, and I understand why, but nowadays you see the blokes from about, you see this, and he's got a plastic collar around him here, and you can't, it could be a computer inside a helmet that's driving the car. And I miss that, the personal, the personal element. I'll tell you what fascinates me. In 1948-49, when the British Grand Prix was at Silverstone, they had an enormous crowd there, and you could get into the paddock for 30 shillings. But there wasn't a problem then. But if you allow the general public into the paddock now in exchange for some money, the drivers would never get to their cars, would they?
No.
So why is that? Is the public less interested now, more interested now?
I think they're as interested now as they were. I mean, the spectator, I don't think the spectator's amount of spectator has gone down that much anyway, has it? I mean,
no.
You know, I mean,
well, it's Silverstone's pegged at 90,000 so that they can at least get a vantage point.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in Mansell's day, when we had Mansell Mania and people with Union Jacks and all the rest of it, and they had 110,000, 120,000 people there all going berserk, you couldn't move.
Mm.
I have to be honest and say I don't really know what it's like for the man in the street.
No.
You don't. You know less about it than
I do. Luckily enough, we have passes for the right places.
If you're prepared to drive there in your car and take hours to get in, as it used to take to get to Silverstone, and pay a lot of money to stand in one place because you can't move, because if you do, someone else is going to take your place, and all you see is the cars come past you 70 times or whatever it is, and you don't really know what's happening because you can't hear the public address on account of the fact that the engines are too noisy.
Absolutely.
Now, you're the two... I mean, I was paid to go there, and I got the best seat in the house, and I could go and talk to anybody I wanted to talk to, and I had a television set to look at. But there's a hell of a difference between watching a Formula One race on your television set at home and having somebody telling you what it's all about, and being there and having the buzz of listening to the engines and all the people around you talking to you. I mean, the atmosphere. I tell a lie, I have actually paid to go to a meeting in my life. And being part of a fraternity of like-minded people who are also... passionate about driver A as opposed to driver B, is a hell of an experience.
We hope you've enjoyed this exclusive podcast, which has been brought to you by Scene Scania magazine. Inside our latest issue, you will find edited highlights of this conversation, together with a unique set of photographs of Murray Walker and Sir Stirling Moss taken on the day they came together for us. Thanks for listening, and watch this space for more exciting and exclusive Scania podcasts coming your way soon.